Dr. Rochefort, and it's very nice to be here reading alongside Mary and Tim. This first poem touches on a court legend which concerns the end of the world and Strindberg's people. There's a side element of Barrack Street on a weekend evening as well. It's called Saturday Night. When Strindberg's angel blows her trumpet, from imagined corners the earth folds up. The living come unscathed from narrow houses, stand against the reclaiming dead. Holy murder in Barrack Street, settling of ancient scores. Dead rains return, the old wind howls forgotten curses down the lane. Never again Sunday morning, the light on glass, blood, and limping dogs. Go the back way, down the steps by the river. Come find me. I did look for Mary in the sense I'm quite happy for you to clap at any point. That was not quite, not maybe during the poem, and the unlikely events that happened. This next poem is about Gérard de Nerval, who was the 19th century French poet, who was said to have a pet lobster, who he would walk at the end of a silk thread through the boulevards of Paris. And this wasn't really true, which is partly what the poem is about. There's a debate that in the poem there's a phrase from Nerval's most famous poem, Où nage la sirène, which means where the siren swims. And there's one other word you possibly know better than me, that arrondissement is a district of... I don't actually know any French. All the French words I know, five or six of them are in these poems. Laughing is also French. This poem is called Apocrypha, after reading Paul Muldoon's Something Else. Draining its absinthe and lemonade, the world-weary lobster slips back on a fur-lined collar and resumes its promenade, trotting before mad Nerval. Don't filter these stories for what's true, or try to find perhaps the better view. Embrace the apocryphal. The truth has claws to slash that gossamer leaves, and swiveling its ancient head, make a dash for the bushes, fleeing at a fair clip in spite of its armor, through quiet arrondissement of the heart, finally giving the slip to the panting bohemian in shallows of refracted light, struggling ragged out of human sight toward the dark cave, Où nage la sirène. Now I think the cat Mary was trying to avoid of you getting obliged. The next poem, I suppose, came from a time when I had a summer job on the 40th floor of the building which overlooked Lake Ontario, and I didn't do much other than look at the sun on Lake Ontario. And a French word, étincelant, meaning sparkling, came to mind, the features in this poem, which is called Travel Light. Pack everything you need, then throw away half. Let's see what you've got. Luminescence, incandescence, evanescence. How long are you going for? And all this, sparkling, dappling, shimmering. What were you thinking of? At the bottom, some heavier bits and bobs, longing, falling, yearning. You can get those anywhere, cheaper too. This in a pocket, étincelant. Put that away or you'll lose it. So it's empty now. You wouldn't have got far carrying all that baggage about, light on water. The next poem is called Moving to the City, and it's set in an airplane where someone is leaving Ireland. Moving to the City. Don't go, said the open country, with a hint of desperation. Details frantically recalled, fields replicating into a map, a million alluring counties you were rising above. Every colour you could wish for, so long as it's green. And the bed-headed clouds, one to every 2 fields, strip tamely after your flame, but their shadows hold back. Supper to the ground, they can't pull clear without ripping out an anchor of their own dimension. Acres of grass and a stretch of road, lying perhaps with valerian or foxglove, leading somewhere forgotten. The next poem is read from time I was on holidays in Turkey, and I saw on the wall of the church an unexpected image of Jesus that was different, and it was explained to me that this wasn't the earthbound Jesus, but rather it was the Jesus Christ that dwells forever in heaven, sort of other than the current 3 years on this planet. So this short poem, which is actually shorter possibly than that explanation, has the title is also the first line. The Christ of all time, of before and after, dwells in heaven on Byzantine walls. Beardless, serene, never left his father's side, or if he did, soon lived down that painful interlude. Now, this next poem is this poem is in a way a law poem, but it's about a shipwreck in the 1840s in which dozens of people lost their lives, including a family with three children, two boys and a girl, which feature in this poem. And it consists of words from the judgment in the legal case which follows the disaster. And it also has phrases from the testimony of Joseph Reed, who was the sole survivor of this shipwreck. Inside it is among other things, is a Latin phrase, ceteris paribus, which means all other things being equal. And the poem, I suppose, has a swirling kind of over your head type quality, I hope. It's called wreckage. Breathe a few seconds the longer at the bottom of the sea, the ship Dalhousie, so as to come up again, hauled myself over on the weather quarter, 16 miles to the southward. The husband had his wife in his arms, heavily over on her starboard beam end, westward of Beachy Head, whether she was alive or dead. A kind of pepper and salt shooting or morning coat. Two medical gentlemen. The two boys were holding on to the mother. Little pieces of wood in the water. Taken and quietly submerged to the bottom of the sea. When the water came up to my knees. Entire credit for speaking scientifically. Trousers on, but not shoes. And I lashed her to the spar. Captain Butterworth sung out, "For God's sake, look here." Grabbing for or trying to lay hold of one of her boys. She would be much obliged to me. With the certainty of fate itself. She knelt over the spar and seemed to be in the act of prayer. Being picked up and having a decent burial. They were all clasped together, partly cut when the knife broke. That must have taken them down. Did not seem to be exerting themselves. He could not call asphyxia death. They were all standing together on the side of the ship. Ceteris paribus. The husband with his wife in his arms. As she was in a distressed state, I went to her. And the two boys clinging to their mother, all clasped together. May God bless you and get you safe to land. Then lying in the River Thames, a sea swept them right off and he saw them no more. Caught her under her arm with my right hand. They all four went down together instantly. Perfectly sincere in their opinion. A whirlpool or eddy. A perfect equipoise. Beating of the sea against the ship. And never rose again. East India docks, bound to Sydney. I don't think they were separated. With the rope I had meant for myself, Her head was hanging over on her shoulder. She was very rough, very sharp, resigned to their fate. If she thought I hadn't better lash her to the spar, the boys were in their night clothes, and with the assistance of James Bewerly, infinitely divisible, lurching very heavily over, a man could not judge very well of time by the ship's rail, the whirlpool made by the heave of the ship's counter. No swimmer could have struggled against that. In her nightdress, when she was hauled out of the quarter gallery, wrecked and lost, the last to leave her, and I'm the only. I'll just read two more poems. This next one has, unlike the other one, has Frankenstein in it. And there's a scene in the book where the monster confronts his creator, who, oddly enough, is out hiking in the Alps on a glacier, and he demands that a wife be made for him, and he threatens to kill all his creator's friends and family if this doesn't happen. And the poem is called Showdown. At Chamonix, on the Mer de Glace, Frankenstein meets Frankenstein's monster. The creature says, "Make me someone to love, or I'll glut the maw of death." They struggle still among swaying alpine trees. You can't win, matched to your monster, who fights like a master. Elegant, fast as thought, though cobbled together from people who are dead. All bolts and scars, he flies like you, kicks, blocks, and soars. Rehearsed or not, the blows are true, the fight won't end. You dream of taking him apart, starting again. And this brings me to the final poem, which is about returning to Ireland from Australia at a time when my father was dying. There's a reference in the poem to a Qibla compass, which is something that shows Islamic travellers the direction in which to pray. It's called Long Haul, in memory of Brendan Mee, 1936 to 2002, and divided up into a number of parts. One, incensed in your coffin at the top of the church, as the priest lay to rest, the wrong man, quiet, kept to himself, I could almost hear your heckle. 2. A tiny stain crept across the map of the world on the bulkhead screen. How high, how fast, how far to go. Once a minute, the Qibla compass pointed to Mecca. 3. Story of tainted milk in the 40s. You in a fever hospital, peering through a fogged pane at parents on the ladder in November cold. Your father says, "You'll be home by Christmas." You scream. Your mother kicks him, and he falls off the ladder, to land 40 years on as a graveyard cop down the hall when I was 10. 4. There was nowhere in Kuala Lumpur Airport to cry. 5. Sometimes they don't tell you when you're finished, but at the dawn, the nights of not going home, days shouting at doctors, while nurses shush and tuck you in, and the morphine starts to work. 6. Your father hated De Valera. For you it was Poppy. Ambushed in full soul, you meant to say Charlie, but Dad slipped out. 7. The time zone's relented. Each slice of the world paid back its toll. When the hours reclaimed, I reached you in time. And you were beautiful, white hair and thin, thin arms. Your father's brows putting over our darkening eyes. Thanks very much.